and turned it into a kind of sorority for Ersebet and her brood. Vans with blacked-out windows shuttled back and forth between it and Dodo headquarters, ferrying witches. They had come from all times and places, but they mostly followed Ersebet's lead when it came to fashion choices. There was also a very small cohort of contemporary witches. Ersebet could smell them, and found it perfectly ordinary to approach strangers on Mass Ave and inform them of their latent abilities, to the despair of everyone who cared about security clearance. Those rare few who responded positively were immediately told it was a joke by me, or Rebecca, or whoever was Ersebet minding that day. Meanwhile, the attendant Dosekop, our version of the Secret Service, would capture an image of the woman's face and send it electronically for identification and background check. If the Dosekop got a green light, they would signal the Ersebet minder, who would backpedal on the just a joke line, and surreptitiously invite the newfound witch to an interview near, not at first, HQ. There were only 3 contempt witches at first. There are now about 8. One of these was Julie Lee, a.k.a. the smart-ass oboist with the tattooed eyebrows from the Apostolic Cafe. Apparently, Ersebet had known her for a witch from day 1, but did not bother to mention it until the mood possessed her. Another was Tanya Wakesa Washington, a legal clerk in City Hall who was a regular at the cafe. The third was Rebecca East Oda. She was a grudging convert. I think she agreed to be recruited more for the sake of supporting an endeavor Frank loved than out of any eagerness of her own. That said, she was quite chuffed with herself the first time she turned an apple into an orange. And with her Congregationalist studiousness, she was apt. Ersebet worked with them every day in one of the Odex, displaying a patience and good humor she revealed nowhere else, teaching them basic magical spells, but it was slow going. Raised in a civilization from which magic had been eradicated for a century and a half, they all suffered a kind of atrophy of the faculties needed to perform it. Ersebet had told me in private that even Julie, the best of them, was probably years away from being able to send a doer with any degree of spatio-temporal accuracy. Our budget seemed limitless at that time, in no small part because there were multiple variations of the Bay's songbook gambit. Famous works of art, rare artifacts and antiques, treasure troves of all sorts. We made them ours, and sold them all for cash. Tristan and I had ethical qualms about this, but Blevins was in charge. The Fugger Bank became our frenemy. Was neither friend nor foe to us. At some times they checked our stratagems. At other times, abetted us, according to some larger plan of their own that eluded our understanding. It became increasingly obvious that Dr. Cornelius Rudge, who'd been in on the project from the beginning, had deep connections to the Fuggers, and was basically serving as their man on the inside. But acquiring treasure was no longer Dodo's primary goal. Oh no, reader, do not think it. Frank and Blevins had an Uber mission. I wonder, shall it seem antiquated or inconceivable, if these words are ever brought to light? I can only guess at what this might have been, and at when they conceived it. At the very beginning of the project? Or at some point during the years when Dodo was growing to the zenith of its power? Only in the last few weeks have I gained an inkling of their true motives. I shall say what I know of these as quickly as I can, because my hand is cramping up like a motherfucker. Cramping up most pitiably. But en route, I must explain what happened in the Constantinople Theater. Yes, Dodo had several distinct theaters of operations, of which Constantinople, circa 1200, was the first, the biggest, and the one that most concerned Tristan and myself. The official rationale for what we were doing there was as follows. At the time of our great thriving, there were, amongst the powers of the globe, multiple entities that caused our government concern. These included China, Russia, and certain nefarious elements in the Middle East. Dodo was tasked with discouraging China and Russia from becoming geopolitical BFFs. From becoming close allies. We were to do this by subtly, retroactively, shifting the historical soul of Russia away from the Eastern Orthodox Church and toward the Roman Catholic one, starting just after the Fourth Crusade. The Fourth Crusade was an epic clusterfuck. A comic opera misadventure. A tragic saga with farcical elements. It never even reached its intended target in the Holy Land. Instead, the Crusaders, Catholics from Western Europe, invaded the Byzantine Empire, which was a Christian land, and sacked Constantinople. Its domino effect throughout history is a remarkable lesson in cause and effect that I will return to at another time, if writer's cramp and leisure time allow it. What matters here is to note the consequences. With the help of the Chronotron and of various spies and sages we sent back to serve as its eyes and ears, we planned out a long, interrelated series of deeds. Any one of these would seem innocuous unto itself. Stealing a pitchfork in some small town in the Urals. Digging a trench in the city of Zara. Moving a sleeping dog from a hut in a back alley in Budapest to another hut 50 feet away. Collectively, these slight alterations pushed our agenda, shifted the quantum tendencies of reality to allow us to form what we ultimately desired. That Catholicism would spread its wings over more of Christendom, and the Orthodox Church over less of it. Catholicism unchecked would mean disaster for both the colonizing of North America and the development of science. And so, every bit of strengthening that happened on the Church's eastern flank had to be offset on its northwestern one to maintain within Europe the tensions and conflicts that would lead to a successful Protestant Reformation. That, too, is a story for another day. But it is important to note here that it involved the collusion of influential bankers, in particular the Fuggers. Grania had indirect connections to that family, owing to her post-Scheer circumstances, and in sundry ways, she greatly assisted us in bringing her generation of Fuggers into the fold, in such manner that subsequent generations were raised to be our natural allies. As I have recently, and painfully learned, she had her own reasons for becoming cozy with the Fuggers. But now I am getting ahead of myself. Back to the Uber mission. Or, to be precise, what Frink and Blevins claimed was the Uber mission. Because the 1204 fall of Constantinople is what brought Catholicism so far east, most of our deeds set off little chain reactions, quiet little tributaries that met up in the central artery of the Fourth Crusade. This meant several things. First, that young Rachel was invaluable to us, not only as a witch, but as a source of information far exceeding all our documented knowledge. Furthermore, we could rely on her to send a doer to that DTAP with uncanny specificity. It also meant that most of our fighters had to be trained to have at least a basic grasp of Greek, spoken by the native Orthodox Christians of Constantinople, Latin, spoken by the crusading Catholics who were besieging them, and Anglo-Saxon, the most common tongue of the Varangian guards. They also learned to fight in both the Eastern style employed by the conscripted army and the Northern style of the Varangians, as well as the various continental styles employed by the wide variety of soldiers from Flanders down to Sicily. There were few actual battles over the two-year course of the Fourth Crusade, but every one of them had been quite the mishmash of styles. I speak from listening to Tristan, who is one of our frontline Fourth Crusade doers. While we were growing and thriving in the 21st century, the witch network was being built out with astonishing rapidity in many DTAPs. Grania, who had taken up with an acquaintance of Francis Bacon, and of the Fuggers, per previously, was worth her weight in diamonds, as rather like Constantinople, late Elizabethan London is, within the time-space continuum of recorded human history, akin to Grand Central Station, especially given that we needed to have KCWs of both Catholic and Protestant backgrounds. Within 18 months, every DTAP we'd targeted had a known compliant witch who knew Grania. Or a witch who knew a witch who knew a witch who knew Grania. We could safely move doers from DTAP to DTAP in ways unthinkable before the Chronotron came online. Grania, whom I had never met, seemed to enjoy her position of prominence. Unlike most of the other witches working with Dodo, whom, it must be said, we spent a not inconsiderable amount of time placating, she asked nothing of us. She was generous and earnest. Our one great blindness, our tragic flaw, is that we never questioned that. But again, I'm getting far ahead of myself.
Incident Report. Author, Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons. Subject, Hira Lajani. Theater, Constantinople. DTAP, Blaherne Palace, 1203. Filed, Day 1787, June, Year 5. Sexual Assault and Repercussions, Ware Guild. Hira Lajani was on assignment in 1203 Constantinople. Her deed put her in the royal wing of Blaherne Palace after sunset. This wing is guarded mostly by the mercenary Varangian guards, of which I, Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons, was one, being there for a separate deed. Under normal circumstances, our paths would not cross. Hira reports that having accomplished her deed, she was returning to Bessina's quarters so that Bessina would home her, when she was accosted by a Varangian guard speaking Greek to her with an accent she has come to recognize as Norman/French. He propositioned her as she was descending a flight of steps leading down from a raised terrace toward the bathhouse entrance in a courtyard below. She turned him down. She is used to being propositioned, especially by the guard, who consider themselves outside the normal social constraints of the local culture. However, she is also used to being respected when she says no. This VG did not accept her no. He grabbed her as she reached a landing in the stairway and pinned her against a stone balustrade. She resisted. He ripped her robe off of her shoulder so that it fell to the sash at her waist. Although he was stronger than she was and did not require a weapon to overpower her, he reached down with his right hand and drew a sea axe, a long knife, from a sheath on his belt, presumably considering this the easiest way to terrorize her into silence. Her assailant was suddenly holding her with his left hand only. In the period combat training that is a requirement for all doers, we are taught to be extremely conscious of when the opponent makes a move for his knife, since that is the single most dangerous moment in hand-to-hand combat. Hira reacted with a wrist-lock technique that forced her assailant to drop the knife. He reached down for it, giving her the opportunity to spin away from the stone balustrade. Now furious and no longer content with merely terrorizing her, the assailant aimed a wild slash at her that produced a shallow but bloody wound on the outside of her right thigh. In doing so, he became imbalanced. Hira stepped in and took advantage of this to throw him, planting her left hip under his buttock and shoving hard on his chin. Spinning away from her, he sprawled over the balustrade, balanced for a moment, then fell, plunging approximately 5 meters onto a wrought iron fence which impaled him. As this was happening, he screamed in a way that drew attention all over the courtyard. Various other Varangian guards came to investigate, then, seeing the wound on her leg, summoned female servants to come and attend to her. The incident was singular enough that word of it spread through the royal wing of the palace within a quarter hour, and through the entire palace compound in an hour. I heard of it from fellow guards, who were reconstructing what move Hira must have used to get him to drop the knife. On the excuse of needing to relieve myself, I made my way to where she was being comforted. This was a small antechamber outside the bathhouse. One of Bessina's attendants was there, holding Hira's torn and blood-soaked dress. Hira was by this time in a fresh robe. She had been washed clean of the blood, and her thigh had been bandaged. She appeared shaken, although when I spoke to her later, she said she just wanted to get on with her deed in hopes of preventing a repeat of the assault in another strand. A contingent of 4 Varangian guards appeared in the doorway. Naturally, given what had just happened, I assumed their intent was hostile. I interposed myself between them and the women, and placed my right hand on the handle of my sea axe. Their leader was Magnus, who was known to me by reputation, being one of the most senior and respected of all the Varangian guards in the city, despite his relative youth, early 30s, and outlier status as a Norman. Most of the VG are Anglo-Saxons, and in this era the Normans and Anglo-Saxons are frenemies at best. He may have recognized my face, but we had never conversed. Magnus is a tall, lean, broad-shouldered, bearded man, with long brown hair and blue eyes. He entered first, displaying both hands, palms out, in a gesture of peace. Behind him were three other men, I would guess of the same kinship group. They muttered together in what I recognized as Norman French. One carried a pile of men's clothes, one carried an ornate wooden box, the third carried a small leather bag. All four were unarmed. They must have checked their weapons outside.
"It's all right, brother. I am here to make this right as best I can," Magnus said, speaking in Anglo-Saxon.
I nodded and stepped out of his way. Magnus stopped just in front of Hera. The other three approached, went down on their knees, bowed their heads, and held up the objects they were carrying.
"I am Magnus of Normandy," began Magnus in stilted, accented Greek. "The man who assaulted you is my distant kinsman. He has no other family, and so it falls to me to offer you the Wehrguild for his offense. He did not have much, but now it is all yours. There are clothes, ornamentation, and money. You will receive it, please."
He gestured, and the men held the items closer to her. Hera could not hide her surprise. She glanced at me briefly, and I nodded, so she accepted the offering with thanks. Basina's attendant and a young servant woman relieved the men of their load, and then gave them a look suggesting they should leave now. Magnus saluted Hera with a fist to his chest. His men rose, turned on their heels, and marched out. Since I had seen for myself that Hera was safe, and it would have been awkward for me to remain as the sole male, I left with Magnus's group. As soon as we were outside the bathhouse, Magnus turned to me to ask my cause for being here. Seeing an opportunity to forge a connection, I said, "This woman has done me a kindness in the past, and I am concerned for her well-being." And I said it in Magnus's own dialect of Norman. He was pleasantly surprised to hear his mother tongue spoken.
"What is your name?" he asked. "You have a familiar accent."
"My name is Tristan of Dintagel," I said. "I spent a year of my youth in Normandy seeking my fortune, before coming east to join the Varangian Guard." He gave me a peculiar look.
"Tristan of Dintagel?"
He glanced over his shoulder at one of his men, who was simultaneously exchanging looks with the other two men.
"Are you a man of great exploits?"
"You must ask the Emperor his opinion on the subject," I said, "as his is the only opinion that matters to my salary." Magnus stared at me a moment longer, and then laughed along with his men.
"It is a pleasure to meet someone who speaks as we do," he said, and held out a hand to exchange peace with me.
I returned to my post, having agreed with him that we would break bread together the next time our duties allowed it. Later that day I found access to Hera again, to find her resolute to finish her deed on this strand, and as I had finished my own deed, I returned here while she was still in Constantinople. She should be home within a day. The wound on her thigh will probably require modern medical treatment and leave a permanent scar, but seems unlikely to cause permanent disability. Respectfully submitted, Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons.
Exchange of posts by Dodo staff on Constantinople Theater, Odin Channel. Days 1790 through 1797, late June, year 5. Post from Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons.
"Gang, I wanted to raise a topic of interest in case anyone else being sent to Constantinople can confirm what I just saw, or gather more info. Long story short,
is that I was hanging out there with Magnus of Normandy, who many of you will have heard of as one of the more senior Varangians. Not so much in terms of formal rank as the respect in which he's held by the other VGs, which is saying something, given he's a Norman. I had crossed paths with him a couple of days earlier, and he had taken an interest in me and suggested we dine together. As everyone knows, it's against SOP to make casual social connections with historicals, since only bad things can come of it, unless you're a lover or a closer, in which case it's part of your job description. So I was hesitant to accept Magnus's invitation. But as I said, he's a respected leader in the VG ranks, and I'm pretty junior. So the invitation was an honor, and it would only have raised more questions and suspicions if I had just blown him off. Further complicating the scenario is that Magnus, who for all his status in the guard has a vaguely manic, WTF aspect, decided we should dine not in the VG mess hall, nor even in the taverns the guard tended toward, but that we should head down to the Venetian neighborhood, because he liked the smell of maritime industry, or something. I went with him, just the two of us, and we got a lot of freaked-out looks from the Venetian traders and their families, because we were, you know, the Emperor's guards, coming into a Venetian neighborhood while the Venetian navy was parked across the Bosporus, threatening to attack the Emperor. But obviously nobody was going to mess with us. We sat down at an outdoor table overlooking the harbor, and had a conversation that on the surface seemed just like polite get-to-know-you stuff. My cover story was designed to stand up under exactly this kind of testing. It is that I came from a pretty obscure location in England, that I had family connections in Normandy, and had spent some time there when younger, which was how I came to speak the dialect. He probed me a little on that. This made me a little nervous, since I'd been in that part of the world, Collinet specifically, 150 years earlier, and so I couldn't cite specific names or incidents to back up my story. But my village and his are some 50 kilometers apart, which is enough separation to blur things quite a bit, and he had left when fairly young, so there weren't any smoking guns. Basically, the cover story seemed to pass muster, and we moved on to other chit-chat about the day-to-day workings of the VG and rumors about the Crusaders and what they were up to. After we'd had a few drinks and a good dinner, we stood up and began to head back to the barracks. But we'd only gone about 100 strides when he turned to me and said, "Would you like to go see your namesake?" Having no idea what he was talking about, I agreed. We were near the border of the Venetian quarter, but now he led me back into the heart of it. We walked for about 100 yards through winding streets. The sun was setting. Time of year was midsummer. Sunset was late. We came to a Roman Catholic church where vespers were underway. This is the Church of St. Bartholomew, for those of you who would care to visit it. Later it was destroyed on all of the strands I'm aware of, so it doesn't exist in our present. Point being, for purposes of this story, its west entrance was lit up by the sunset when we arrived. He led me into the church, both of us crossing ourselves in the traditional manner as we entered. I doubt Magnus is a practicing Christian of any stripe, and when the VG guards the Empress at religious services, it's an Orthodox church, so he must have vestigial muscle memory from childhood, re how to behave in a church. We went inside just far enough that we could turn around and look at the stained glass windows in the west front without drawing the attention of the congregants or the priest. There's a big round window in the middle and some smaller ones to the sides. As is typical of churches like this, the big one depicts scenes from the life of Jesus, with emphasis on St. Bartholomew, one of the 12 apostles, and the peripheral ones depict various other saints. One of the stained glass windows depicted a knight with yellow hair holding what appeared to be a boat oar. Scattered around him on the ground were the supine forms of what I took to be defeated enemies. Behind him was a crude rendering of a church. A scroll above his head identified him as St. Tristan of Dintagel. As you can all imagine, I was astonished and speechless for a minute. I became conscious of the fact that Magnus was studying my face intently. When I finally came to my senses, I said, "I had no idea that my saintly namesake had been commemorated in a church so far from home," and thanked him for making me aware of it.
I fell to my knees in a show of piety, offered up a prayer to St. Tristan, and purchased a candle, which I lit and placed beneath the window in question. Magnus and I then walked back up to the barracks without further discussion of this incident. As far as I can tell, he accepts my story, which is that I was named after a saint who dwelled in my part of the world 150 years ago. But until this incident, I had no idea that there was such a thing as a St. Tristan of Dintagel recognized by the Catholic Church. Since I came back, I found traces of him on the Internet, but it's all pretty sketchy and obscured by glamour. I'm guessing that St. Tristan became a thing on certain strands, but not others. Any ideas, people?
Response from Dr. Melisande Stokes.
On it. We'll get back to you with any findings. It kind of sounds like Magnus set you up. Any worries on that front?
From Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons.
He didn't call me out. But I won't BS you, Stokes. It's worrisome, and I think he senses something's weird about me. On the other hand, it's only 2 weeks until the Crusaders storm Galata Tower, and then we'll be going our separate ways. So I intend to go back to the DTAP on schedule tomorrow. For me to just disappear would confirm any suspicions he might be harboring.
From Dr. Melisande Stokes.
Can you delay your return to Constantinople? A bunch of us are working this and coming up with spotty/fluctuating results. There is heavy glamour around St. Tristan of Dintagel, and so we're seeing entire Wikipedia articles warping in and out of existence. Some risk that merely Googling the name is tending to make it more real.
From Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons.
So what is the point of delaying my return to Constantinople? Shizzle's about to go down, you know this. We've been working toward it for 3 years.
From Dr. Melisande Stokes.
We can get better answers by sending some sages back to other strands, where we think that the St. Tristan legend is more firmly entrenched. We need to know more before sending you into a potentially messed up situation. And by messed up situation, I mean alternate universe in which you are a 200-year-old warrior saint.
From Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons.
No research needed. St. Tristan is damn well entrenched in the strand I'm working. I already told you he has at least one stained glass window. So we have to stick with the story I told Magnus, which is that I'm simply named after him. Stokes, this is ubiquitous. Almost everyone back then is named after a saint.
Letter on parchment, handwritten in Latin by professional scribe, Constantinople. June 1203.
Brother Ando, may the Lord find you and our mother well. Upon receiving this letter, please respond as swiftly as you may. I have met a valiant warrior here in Byzantium, a Varangian guard like myself, but of a name too familiar, that is Tristan of Dintagel, which lies in England. The rantings of the Frankish priests are gibberish to me, so I care not for their saints. Nor was I ever one to listen to the songs around the hearth, but I know you well. Do you not recall a song about a great hero who hailed from a remote part of England and who had appeared suddenly in our region and fended off a tribe with whom we feuded? He was credited with saving the village and made a saint by the Christians. It strikes me as a remarkable coincidence to meet another man with such a name. There is some quality to this man that I cannot quite describe, but he seems like a man apart, as belonging to some other race. I wonder if there be miracles, and if so, how may I make use of this one, that a hero of legend has seen fit to manifest himself within my ken, just at the moment when we are under siege by the Franks? Please respond to tell me if my memory is correct, and say as much as you can of the old legends concerning this hero. Also, send news of our mother and the village, if there is any. Your brother, Magnus.
Exchange of posts by Dodo staff on Constantinople Theater, Odin Channel. Days 1798 through 1805. Early July, Year 5. Post from Historical Operations Subject Matter Authority, HOSMA, Dr. Eloise Lebrun.
I'm just back from 1232 Paris with some results concerning Saint Tristan of Dintagel, which I will post on this channel as I've time to write them up. But the executive summary is that I don't think Lieutenant Colonel Lyons should go back to Constantinople. Has he been sent yet? I can't make heads or tails of the deed scheduling app.
Response from Dr. Melisande Stokes.
He was sent 8 hours ago and isn't expected back for 2 weeks. This is where we complete the deed during the Crusaders' attack on the Galata Tower at Constantinople. What did you find?
From Dr. Eloise Lebrun.
Ugh, I just missed him. Well, it's all academic now, I guess. What I found is that on some of these strands, an oral tradition developed in the vicinity of Colonnais, in which the story of Tristan got inflated into a bigger and bigger yarn, and eventually turned into a chanson de geste sung by various troubadours. Apparently, it was popular enough that the church decided to capitalize on it by trumping him up enough to canonize him. Even though there are no miracles or martyrdom attributed to him, which is how he found his way into a stained glass window.
From Dr. Melisande Stokes.
On multiple strands? But he only hit the burglar with the boat oar on one strand.
From Dr. Eloise Lebrun.
Crosstalk between strands, apparently.
From Dr. Melisande Stokes.
Is that a thing? Would one of our magic experts please enlighten me?
From Rebecca East Oda.
We've seen it before in creative arts settings, especially storytelling. If you think about what is going on in a storyteller's mind when he or she spins a fictional yarn, what they are trying to do is to come up with a story that did not actually happen, but that seems as if it might have happened. In other words, it has to make sense and to be plausible. Typically, such a story makes use of real places, historical events, characters, etc. But the events of the story itself seem to take place in an alternate version of reality. The conventionally accepted explanation for this is that storytellers have a power of imagination that makes them good at inventing counterfactual narratives. In the light of everything we've learned about strands at Dodo, however, we can now see an alternate explanation, which is that storytellers are doing a kind of low-level magic. Their superpower isn't imagining counterfactuals, but rather seeing across parallel strands and perceiving things that actually did, or might, happen in alternate versions of reality. I think you can see where this is going, Mel. Even if Tristan smacked the burglar with the oar on only a single strand, it's possible that storytellers in other nearby strands were able to sense it or perceive it and tell the story in a compelling, convincing way. From there, the story could propagate to other strands, including ours, where just this morning I found an entry on St. Tristan of Dintagel in Alban Butler's original 1759 edition of Lives of the Saints, which is in our library.
From Dr. Melisande Stokes.
Holy crap, he's on Wikipedia now, too. NVM, he's gone now.
From Dr. Eloise Lebrun.
I don't have time to translate all of the documents from Latin and medieval French into English, but I'll post a few snippets.
From Dr. Roger Blevins.
Just became aware of this thread and am skimming it. Am I to understand that changes have occurred recently on the pages of a 250-year-old book in our library?
From Dr. Melisande Stokes.
Yes. There are faint traces of glamour around it, according to Ersebet.
From Dr. Roger Blevins.
I see. That is troubling. Not the first time diachronic magic has been troubling.
From Dr. Melisande Stokes.
How so, Dr. Blevins? The entire point of Dodo is to change the present by doing things in the past. History books and Wikipedia entries are naturally going to change accordingly.
From Dr. Roger Blevins.
Dr. Stokes, I am taking this offline, as the expression goes. Please see me in my office.
From Dr. Eloise Lebrun.
Here, for example, is a translation of a letter in clerical Latin from a village priest in Normandy to his bishop, dated 1063. The struggle against pagan beliefs and practices in this parish is never-ending, and tests my faith every hour of every day. Of late, some of the village wives have been filling their children's ears with a story that is spread like a grass fire from one household to the next. It is nothing more than an old saga of the Vikings, so far as I can discern. Its hero is one Tristan, a roaming Anglo-Saxon warrior of enormous strength and stature, who comes to sojourn in a Norman village for a time. Peaceable by nature, he is roused to action when the village is raided by brigands and makes an heroic stand on the shore, laying about him with a boat oar until all of the attackers have been slain. Then, after accepting the gratitude of the villagers, he wanders away to pursue other adventures. As you can see, it is just the sort of lay that appeals to the simple minds of the common people, and as such is nearly impossible to eradicate. There is a response from the bishop, in which he says that he has heard the same story from other villages in the area, but that in some versions, Tristan is a Christian man who is defending the parish church from pagans who have come to defile it and steal its reliquary. He goes on to suggest that rather than trying to stamp out this popular story, the priest should instead co-opt it by retelling it to his flock as a tale about Christian virtues. Jumping forward 100 years, I found a fragment of an obscure chanson de geste. I'm dating it by its form, which fluctuates between the early style, 10-syllable assonant rhyme, in this case on short I, and the later one, 12-syllable monorhyme, in this case long I. Here's a few stanzas, just to convey the flavor of it, although, of course, I'm translating for meaning, not nuance. Stanzas are of variable length, and most of them too water-damaged to make out. Can go back and do a more careful translation, if required, including seeking possible encoded messages/references, not unheard of in this tradition. By the banks of the peaceful Dive, Tristan reclines, broad-shouldered with noble carriage and proud spirit, flaxen-haired knight of Tintagel, new-pledged to Charlemagne. He's come to serve our king, the servant of Jesus Christ. About 6 stanzas illegible. Luke, from the loins of his enchanting mistress, at dawn he leaps to the alarms of the invading baleful-eyed Edens, who come to steal the village's beloved relics of Saint Septimus, to dishonor its Christian spirit, a war much worse than sin. 2 dozen unreadable stanzas. And now does noble Tristan, Charlemagne's new paladin, clap hand on oar, and calling upon Our Lady's virtues, use the humble oar as staff to smite the unsanctified chins of 7 pagan warriors in buckram suits, while their gleaming wicked swords no target hit on Tristan's manly, bold, courageous side. There's about another 900 verses, but most are too water-damaged, and at a glance, the rest seem to be about Tristan's service at Charlemagne's court, and later his adventures against the Moors, which presumably would justify his canonization. We'll now peruse that section, and let you know if anything leaps out that might click for Magnus.
from Dr. Stephen Moore.
Sorry to be a Johnny come lately to this thread, but the Bodleian Library was closed yesterday, and so I've only just been able to visit the rare books room. I was able to find traces of the Tristan legend in a letter written in 1071 to William the Conqueror. The original is, of course, in Latin, but I've supplied a hasty translation, copy-pasted below, with apologies for infelicities in language. Greetings to my beloved monarch and cherished brother William, by the grace of God, King of the English and Duke of the Normans. As I circuit the many manors you have seen fit to bestow upon me for my assistance at Hastings, I remain profoundly grateful for your beneficence and generosity. All are bountiful with crops and livestock, the serfs healthy and none excessively aggrieved. In all I receive it as a tremendous boon. However, I am sorrowful to inform you that my search for the hero colony of Dintagel has come to naught. Dintagel, from which sprang that most renowned and admired knight Tristan, who is featured so valiantly in the Song of Colonne in its defense of the holy reliquary of the martyr Saint Septimus of Pontchardon, against the incursions of the heretics of Lisieux that enthralled us in our youth, has proven to be nothing but a spit of land with a ruined Roman fortress. In the nearby village of Boschini, my men have asked after the fellowship of knights from which Tristan sprang, and are met universally with stupid looks from the villagers. There is, however, an abundance of sheep, which may be exploited to the profit of your majesty and the greater glory of God. Yours in great love and all homage, Robert, Count of Mortaigne and Earl of Cornwall.
Post by Dr. Roger Blevins to Lieutenant General Octavian K. Frank on Private Odin Channel, 15-32-37. Day 1805, July, Year 5.
Aki, this is just to give you a heads up on a possible situation that is developing. You'll recall a bit of unpleasantness 2.5 years ago, when Lieutenant Colonel Lyons went off half-cocked during a deed in 1045 Normandy and got into a brawl with the locals. I said at the time, and I still maintain, that this was a serious error in judgment that called his qualifications for the job into question. Well, now it looks like the chickens are coming home to roost. Lieutenant Colonel Lyons has gone back to 1203 Constantinople to finish out the big deed we have been working for the last 3 years. That's fine as far as it goes. Unfortunately, his actions in Normandy 160 years earlier have had incalculable reverberations, with the result that he is now revered as some combination of a romantic folk hero and Christian saint by people all over the Nordic and Christian worlds. One of the Varangian guards at the Constantinople DTAP seems dangerously close to putting two and two together. No action needed or requested at this time, but I wanted to put this up on your radar just in case it blows up in our faces in a few days or weeks. I just finished a rather unpleasant meeting with Dr. Stokes, who is reflexively defensive of Lieutenant Colonel Lyons and doesn't seem to appreciate the magnitude of the problem.
Response from Lieutenant General Frank.
Blev, I've read this a couple of times and don't see why you are so excited. I've spent my career running operations in places like Fallujah and Jalalabad, and I've never seen anything go off without glitches. But you have a better grasp of these diachronic operations than I do, and so I'll take it under advisement. Are you doing anything to mitigate the problem?
From Dr. Blevins.
We have a young Muon here who I am sure you will remember, since she is the one who crashed the ribbon-cutting party by materializing in the Odek. Rachel is her name. She is now one of our most experienced witches, and is obviously an expert on 1203 Constantinople, since it's where she was born and raised. I have a meeting scheduled with her in which I will explore some options for cleaning up the mess that Lieutenant Colonel Lyons has left in his wake.
From Lieutenant General Frank.
How's it going with the portable ODAC and so on? Knowing how your mind works, Blev, I can see where all of this is leading. A de-emphasis on diachronic operations per se, in favor of C-COD psyops centered on witches and mobile units.
From Dr. Blevins.
You know me well, Aki. Yes, the ATO, as we call the portable ODAC, is shaping up quite well. To develop the psyops wing of the organization, we are getting ready to bring forward Grania, who is, after all is said and done, still the most powerful witch we have ever encountered.
From Lieutenant General Frank.
The Irish Super Witch?
From Dr. Blevins.
That terminology is deprecated. We have been calling them Wenders for their superior ability to navigate between strands while maintaining an unbroken thread of consciousness. In the entire history of Dodo, we have only encountered three of them. Grania has been by far the most loyal, and it's time we rewarded her with a promotion.
Letter from Grania to Grace O'Malley. A Tuesday of High Summer, 1602.
Auspiciousness and prosperity to you, milady. It's a brief but timely warning I'm writing you with, Your Grace, and no action does it require on your part, but only alertness. Sir Francis Bacon, the gentleman whose demeanour does command this fleet of thinkers and doers of the age, including Monsieur Cardigan, my benefactor, he urges the nobles of the court to redouble their efforts in Ireland. He would have the crown take over our entire island as a means to honour. Therefore, if any courtier from England do come courting you, it's wise to be testing the waters of their acquaintanceship with Sir Francis. If they are even indirectly under his sway or in his circles, then surely it's disingenuous their being. And meanwhile, merely to keep you apprised of my circumstances, they continue apace with some fascinating developments, more fascinating to myself than to you, I warrant. It's Norwich we're spending the summer in, and here I've come to know three witches, something older than myself and sisters to each other. All of them half-nieces of Sir Francis Bacon himself. For isn't their father, Nathaniel, his half-brother? But this isn't the only peculiar thing about them, there being three other facts of note. First, being that they know of Tristan's guild, and likewise work to abet them on occasion, not so oft as I do. Of course, I knew that there are many other witches working for them. Their term for us, collective, is KCW. But I had not realized I had contemporaries. A second and stranger fact of note being that they were never recruited, but rather raised in a tradition of service to Tristan's crew. For sure their mother Anne, and before that her mother Winifred, worked with Tristan's people, although there is nothing in the family history of working with Tristan himself. 'Twas Winifred was won over to the work by an agent named Esme 40 years ago. Here again, a minor detail Tristan's not telling me about how his guild does be doing their business. But here's the final and most interesting note, and might even be of direct interest to Your Grace. Besides their connection to Sir Francis, these weird sisters are the granddaughters of none other than Sir Thomas Gresham, who, as you know, was an associate of the Fugger banking family, who, despite their unholy religion, have long financed your resistance on occasion for the sheer joy of causing headaches to Queen Bess. I'm thinking it must be no coincidence that all of these particular lineages and associations twine together through time in some way that Tristan sees more clearly than I do. And surely it's use he's getting out of it in ways that I'm not seeing yet. But I will. Oh yes, Your Grace, it's soon enough I'll see as clear as he does. Whether I be near or far, may I hear only good things of you, my Lady Grania. Eure Gronje, now of Norwich.
Transcript, excerpt. Interview conducted by Dr. Roger Blevins with Muon Rachel Bot Avraham. 11 o'clock, day 1807. 10 July, year 5. Notes. Video recording was made automatically by a motion-activated security camera system in Conference Room 2 at Dodo HQ, Cambridge, Massachusetts. In the wake of subsequent events, the file was salvaged from a secure server by Dodo personnel and transferred to the ad hoc Grimnir backup system, where it was later transcribed. Excerpt below begins at approximately 11:15 local time.
In preparing for this meeting, I took the routine step of reviewing your file. I see you have once again started asking the doers you send back to your native DTAP to get word to your family that you're safe.
Yes, I am sure they are worried about me. It has been nearly 3 years. I want to reassure them.
You signed a non-disclosure agreement. That means nothing can be disclosed to anyone.
Except God, you mean. You cannot tell me to keep anything from God.
Ask God to tell your family how you're doing.
I do, of course. But I am a good daughter, and so I must make the effort as well.
No, you mustn't. In fact, you signed a paper swearing you would not.
The commandments come before any pledge I make to a worldly regime, and the commandments say, honor your father and...
You ran off. You abandoned them.
No. My mother is the one who sent me. Weeping. I had her blessing. She said she would make it all right with my father. I am the fastest sender of all the witches and the most precise. I am a benefit to you because my mother sent me here. It is okay that I send reassurances to her.
You can't. If you insist on attempting it, we will assign you to other deeds, and you will never send anyone back to Constantinople.
Will you lame yourselves out of spite? I am the best witch for Constantinople.
Security is our first priority. If you will not cooperate with us, then we cannot cooperate with you. I will have to reassign you to the Antwerp and London DTAPs. We will need additional help there when we bring Gronje forward.
But I am Tristan's preferred sender for Constantinople.
Lieutenant Colonel Lyons is subordinate to me, and all of his decisions are subject to my review.
I understand.
In any case, his habit of disappearing into remote DTAPs for weeks at a time leaves an operational void, obliging colleagues to fill in for him.
Constantinople is not remote. It is the most cosmopolitan city in the world.
Not for long.
What does that mean?
After what happens next, everything looks so different that it doesn't matter how well you know the city. It'll be completely rebuilt.
What do you mean by these words, what happens next?
I have reason to believe that by going back to 1203 Constantinople, Tristan has blundered into a trap of his own devising. Unwittingly, of course. But he is still culpable because of his arrogance, his lack of accountability.
What sort of trap?
The details are complicated. There's not time to explain them here. The point is that he needs to be evacuated. If he were a commando on some kind of raid, we'd be sending in the helicopters right now, the SEAL team, to extract him from the mess he has made. But since he's a doer and he's been deployed to a DTAP, instead we need to send someone who knows the territory and who can get to him and home him with extreme prejudice, as the saying goes.
You want me to send another doer to rescue him?
You're not listening, Rachel. The person we send back on this rescue mission can't just be any ordinary doer. It must be a muon, a witch who has the capability of homing him as soon as he is found. One who is intimately familiar with every byway of the city, every nuance of its languages.
You are asking me to be sent back.
Odek number 4 has been made ready for action. One of our other muons is there waiting for you. I have provided her with cover, with plausible deniability. You can be back home in 10 minutes, if that is what you really want. But you can never come back. You must decide now.
Urgent Bulletin. Missing: Rachel Bat Avraham. Missing since today, 11:25, July 10. Missing from Conference Room Number 2, Top Floor. Details: during interview with Dr. Blevins, became combative, removed pepper spray device from purse, discharged it toward Dr. Blevins, fled the room. When he had finished washing the residue from his eyes, she was gone. Security reports she has not exited the building, however, her whereabouts are unknown. Appearance: long, dark hair, pale skin, dark eyes. Dressed in gray sweater dress and Jodhpur boots. Lots of eye makeup and bangles. Late teens, speaks heavily accented English. Security is currently searching the building, which is in lockdown. Rachel lives in the Muon residence. We have contacted or left word with the off-shift Muons there. Also sending word to local precincts and hospitals. Likeliest that she is hiding in the building somewhere, waiting for somebody else to leave so that she can sneak out. Journal entry of Rebecca East Oda.
July 10th. Temperature, 79 degrees Fahrenheit, dry, still, barometer steady. Faring well, cucumber, squash, chard. Starting to harvest basil leaves, reseeding salad greens. Frank called from the Dodo offices to say he will not be home for dinner. The building is in lockdown because the witch Rachel assaulted Blevins. How very satisfying that must have been. And disappeared. Surprised it took this long for somebody to snap.
Exchange of posts between Dr. Melisande Stokes and Mortimer Shore on private Odin channel. 11:20 to 11:25. Day 1807.
Where's Rachel?
I don't know. Checking her calendar.
NVM. Calling her. One sec.
Looks like she had an 11 o'clock with Blev.
When to VM?
Conference room 2.
I know, but something crazy happened. Blev called security. Medics are there. No Rachel.
Where are you?
OMW down to Odex. WHT Rachel.
See you down there.
Bio breach.
Huh?
Rachel ran through decon area. Didn't follow protocol.
I see you through glass wall now.
Fuck. Whole place will have to be scrubbed. Going in to check Odex.
Someone's in number 4. Check that first.
Okay.
Not on calendar.
It's Nadia.
Who?
New Muon.
Rachel?
Gone.
Never there, or...
Nadia's confused, says she just homed Rachel.
Urgent Bulletin. Update. Okay, everyone, Mortimer here. There's a lot of confusion, and so I've been asked to post a temporary status update. Rachel Bat Avraham was homed back to 1203 Constantinople from ODEC number 4 at about 11:25. This was an unauthorized operation. The Muon who performed the homing was using the ODEC for routine training when Rachel showed up and demanded to be let into the ODEC. Once inside, Rachel employed psyops, magical, techniques to induce the other Muon to affect the homing spell. Unless you hear otherwise, rest in peace, Rachel Bat Avraham. There's going to be a lot of wiki confusion over the next hour or so. Please stay away from all Constantinople-related entries until end of day tomorrow, or you'll get even more confused. Tomorrow, you may find references to a conflagration or explosion or firestorm around Galata Tower in Constantinople, July 1203. If you are one of the Byzantine doers or historians, it might not match your memories of the battle for Galata Tower.